Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and photographer Stephen Trimble, and we're talking about his new book, The Mike File, A Story of Grief and Hope. Stephen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
No, I'm delighted to be here, Mark.
This is a very personal book. It reveals a lot about yourself. And whenever, and it's not often that I come across authors who've written books that are that personal. Did you have any trepidations, any cautions that I was going to put myself all the way out there for the public?
I really didn't. I feel like I can be totally transparent. I have nothing to hide. But it took me a long time to get to be that personal. I've been writing nonfiction for years and years, but it's been way farther out there at a distance from me. And it took a number of years working on this project to really get back to where I felt about the story.
In reading the book, it sounds like that even talking about Mike was something that you had to get to. It's not something you were comfortable with in the beginning.
That was our family ethic. That was our family choice. And really, the beginnings of the book came when I decided, okay, I am going to talk about Mike. I am going to find out what happened. I'm going to research and figure out what happened to Mike in his life. Who was my mother at 20 when she had Mike? You know, I started with that research. And of course, I waited until everybody died before I started.
That's true for a lot of people who write books like this that are so personal and so revealing of things of your family life. Now, let's, for the benefit of the audience, Mike was your older brother. He was born of your mother, but with a different father. And Mike had problems from the get-go. How would you describe his problems?
Well, my mom had Mike at 20, and he was born in 1942, and he was 5 years old. Well, my mother then divorced that guy almost immediately. You know, it was a bad choice, bad marriage, abusive man. And when Mike was 5, she married my dad, and I came along 3 years after that. So Mike was 8 years older than me.
And so you grew up with Mike as your older brother.
Yeah, he was my big brother. I loved him. You know, I adored him when I was a little kid.
But when did you first realize as a child that Mike had challenges?
Well, some of this is looking backward, Mark, and with family stories. Because by the time I was 6, Mike was gone. And so when I was a little kid, Mike was diagnosed as retarded. That was the word we used in those days. Learning disabilities, hard to get through school. My mom tutored him heroically every night, sitting at the yellow formica of our kitchen table, and got him through those first 6 years of regular school. And clearly, I knew something about that, but I was a little kid. And when he moved into special ed in middle school, the very early, early days of special ed. But at 14, he basically hit a psychotic break. He became violent, potentially violent anyhow. I have this memory. I guess the answer to your question is really this one fundamental memory that I have just before he left. When I was 6, Mike was 14, and he was caging my mother against the wall in the kitchen.
Wow.
He was big. He was almost 6 feet high at 14, 6 feet tall. And he was screaming at her, and I ran out and hid in the garage. And that was the searing memory that I had of him living with us. And my parents were at wit's end and had him checked out by the psychiatric hospital in Denver where we live. And they gave him this second diagnosis, paranoid schizophrenia, capable of violence. And he was committed by court order to the Colorado State Hospital and left home and never lived at home again. And so really that memory of me hiding in the garage, I think of as the beginning of the story.
This is also a story about the scandalous failure of public policy dealing with people with different kinds of emotional and psychological problems in Colorado, but also in the nation. And it's also about there was a period of national deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill that went on. I lived through it here in Massachusetts, and that led to it. It was, I guess, well intended. I mean, how would you describe that for people who aren't familiar with it?
Oh my! Well, we almost have to kind of go through a few decades of public policy to get to the answer.
Yeah, I mean, this is the story of how public policy has basically failed people who are thus challenged.
That's right. And Mike lived through that. And in many ways, his story parallels our failures. You know, he went to the state hospital in Colorado in 1957, right after. He just barely missed that period when we were giving people lobotomies and, putting them in cold water baths to make them hypothermic because we thought that would help, and massive doses of electroshock. You know, he came in to the hospital just about the time that we switched from all of that to just overdosing everybody with Thorazine and turning them into zombies, but easily controlled and easily.
Right. It was all about management.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so in those early, you know, and I have very little actual data on what Mike's therapy or the comments from a psychiatrist. It was really hard to get any of that. It's all been destroyed. But I know pretty much what the hospital was doing. And so he was at the state hospital system for about 10 years. And he just missed the real horrors, but I think he must have spent a lot of time doped up on Thorazine. And in those years, they began to reform the hospital. There was a lot of publicity about these places being, you know, quote, America's concentration camps. And they began to think about, okay, what can we do better? And it was really JFK. It was President Kennedy who had famously had a sister,
right,
Rosemary, who had been lobotomized and institutionalized and dealt with in a, you know, just a horrific way. And his family pushed him really hard to come up with some reforms for our mental health treatment system. And so he came up with a community health center idea, and he pushed it through Congress just before he was assassinated. And the idea was we would move people out of state hospitals, move them back into their communities where there would be local support. And that really is the way to go, but that requires enormous funding nationwide.
I was going to say the failure was on the second part of that, local support.
Exactly.
That's where it didn't happen.
Yep. You know, it happened briefly, but it didn't last more than a few years. And so we began emptying the state hospitals. The Colorado State Hospital had 6,000 people when Mike went there, and today it has 500, and they're mostly people who have been convicted of, you know, major crimes and have been sent to the hospital instead of the prison because of, quote, insanity. And so we emptied the hospitals, but we did not fund anything as an alternative. And so Mike and most of his cohorts ended up back in their communities, briefly with support, but mostly ending up just being warehoused in boarding houses with some federal money coming in through Social Security disability. And then many people ended up on the streets. And our, you know, the homeless population, the homeless issue nationwide goes right back to that real destruction of the community health center system, which was finished off by Reagan. Reagan was the nail in the coffin on that.
Oh, yeah. It's sobering after reading your book to realize I'm not sure how much progress we've really made in this regard. I mean, yeah, there's psychiatrists and drugs for people who are essentially ambulatory and able to go to work and so on and so forth. But for people who really need assistance, I have to believe most of the communities throughout the United States are just not meeting the needs.
That's absolutely true.
And especially now in COVID.
Yeah, and now it's even worse. And you know, mental illness is not rare. You know, 1 in 5 adults in America experience mental illness every year. You know, we all have people in our orbit, someone in our family or a friend who struggles with maybe mild depression or maybe something much more severe. And we have not made much progress. You know, as one of the caregivers that I interviewed said, you know, the mentally ill don't have a very big lobby when it comes to lobbying for funding. And so it's shocking that we are in the same place in so many ways.
What was the Mike file?
So in my,
this is a wild story, by the way, Stephen.
Yeah. We didn't talk about Mike. My parents and I formed this little triad, this little trio of close family while Mike was gone all those years. And my dad was a government geologist. We would go away every summer and do rent a house somewhere in the West where he was doing his field work. And Mike was just way out there at the edges of our lives. And, you know, if someone asked me if I had a sibling, I said, yeah, I have this brother, this half-brother. He's off in a psychiatric hospital. And that was pretty much it in the years when he was alive. And so through those years, my mother, who was the pivotal person, of course, and emotionally, this was her son. My dad was just the stepfather. Occasionally she would have something to save. There were the court records when he was committed. There were a few fragmentary medical records. And after 10 years in the state hospital system, Mike was released back to Denver in 1966 when we started mainstreaming everybody. And he tried rejoining our family. You know, I was a teenager. He was in his 20s. And we kind of imagined he would just come back and sit down at the table and be a guy who in our family. But there was way too much resentment in his brain. He was bitter. He was angry. He was resentful that he had been banished. And almost certainly he was misdiagnosed. He probably had maybe depression. Maybe he was on the autism spectrum. You know, we don't know what he had at this point, but probably nothing as severe as his original diagnosis. And so he came back, and he would leave, storm out every time he would come for dinner, and just leave chaos in his wake. And so just a few months after he had come back to Denver, he wrote my mother a series of letters. And in those letters, he cycles back and forth between just accusation and anger and apology and just complete pain about what was happening to him. But the upshot was he cut off contact, and he said, I don't want to be with you. Leave me alone forever. I have to go off and live my life. And so my mother put those letters in a folder. So now we've got the court records, a few fragmentary hospital records, and those letters. And then 10 years after that, Mike died in just terrible, tragic, and public circumstances. And there were a series of newspaper articles about him. And I imagine we'll get to that in our conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
And those newspaper articles were in the file, too. So there was this envelope that my mom saved of really the record of Mike's life. And that circulated around in our records in our house. At one point, my mom tried to throw it away because it was so emotionally painful. And my dad retrieved it. And my mom died, and my dad had that file. We always called it the Mike file. And when I would visit him in Denver from my home in Utah, every once in a while he'd say, Steve, you know, you should take the Mike file, stash it away in family history. And I always forgot, you know, forgot in quotes. That file was incendiary emotionally. You know, I knew what was in there, but I'd never really grappled with it. And when my dad was in his 90s, he called me one day and said, I think I threw the Mike file away by mistake.
Wow.
He was culling papers, and he is losing his eyesight. And he really thought he had thrown it away. But when my dad died in 2011 and we went through his papers, there it was. You know, it was just deathless. And so a year after he died, I spilled the contents of the Mike file across my desk and said to myself, okay, let's do it. Let's see what's in here. Let's see what it means to you. And that was the genesis of this book.
I have to believe first opening that file was a wrenching moment for you.
Well, I knew what was in there, and I had looked at it casually over the years. But yeah, it was wrenching.
Because in your book, you said you essentially had walled Mike's life off from your own, and it was mm-hmm. only in the final drafts of this book did I begin to replace my mother with our mother.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that horrifying?
Well, okay, and I think you're reacting to your own reaction, but from an outsider point of view, when these kinds of tragedies visit a family, I think that's a natural response to try to wall yourself up and separate it. But it is a big moment to come to that realization.
Yeah, there was a lot of self-protection there. And, you know, one of the things I realized in working on the book that I'd never really thought about was how powerful an influence Mike was on me.
Right.
You know, I always thought of myself as, you know, a pretty easygoing guy, not a lot of angst, and close to my parents, and, you know, the good guy. But I never really thought at all about how I made myself the good son so that I would not be the bad son, the troubling son.
Huh.
And that was another amazing self-realization. You know, self-realization takes a long time. And that moment when I realized, yeah, this was our mother I'm talking about, not just my mother. That was a big one.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and photographer Stephen Trimble. And we're talking about his book. It's a powerful memoir, The Mike File, A Story of Grief and Hope. When you open the file, you had to do a lot of detective work on your own to try to fill in the blanks. There were a lot of questions. You obviously want to know, how was he treated? What happened to him while he was in the hospital? And how successful were you in filling in those blanks?
Well, that's what I love to do. You know, I've been, this is my 25th book, and I've been writing nonfiction about the West, Western landscape, and Native peoples for years and years and years. And so research is my happy place. And so emotion was not necessarily where I started. I started with research, and I love doing it. You know, my mother was born in Montana and grew up in the world of immigrant Jews in Butte and Livingston, Montana. And I was really intrigued with that. And I thought, I need to know who my mother was at 20.
Yeah.
And so I spent vast amounts of time researching that and writing it, all of which had to be eventually pulled out of the book because it was just blocking the story of Mike. And at the same time, I was going to Denver and Pueblo, where the Colorado State Hospital is, and trying to find out everything I could. And, you know, the state hospital had destroyed its records in the 80s. But it's amazing what's out there. You know, one day I thought, you know, I bet the county school system where Mike went to elementary school has some records. So I called them up, and they sent me the notes Mike's teachers made in elementary school.
Oh, that was
year to year.
You know, that was a great train of thought to read their, like, one-sentence evaluations, which doomed Mike to what happened to him.
Yeah. No, I was amazed that those things still existed. You know, I tracked down, I wanted to know who Mike's biological father was. All I knew was his name. And so I tracked down his history, where he was born. I found his family. He died many years ago. Actually, he committed suicide, never remarried. He was sort of a ghost in his own family. But I met those folks. I went to Mike's aunt's 106th birthday party in California.
Wow.
You know, on another day, I was noticing that the newspaper articles about Mike's death referred to his autopsy several times. So I called up the Denver Medical Examiner's office, and the next day they emailed me Mike's autopsy report.
Whoa.
You know, it's amazing what is out there. So I couldn't get very much about the actual treatment details of Mike at the hospital. But I was able to interview, you know, psychiatric technicians who worked at the hospital and psychiatrists in their late 80s who were, you know, the primary doctors at the hospital. And so I thought I got a really decent sense of what it was like, even though I couldn't ever find anyone who actually remembered Mike or knew Mike.
What's fascinating reading the book, and I think this is true of a lot of people like myself, we have a tendency to not think that people who are so situationed as Mike, as having some kind of inner life that would be interesting. But as you mentioned in the book, he loved rock music, cared about his clothes. And there were other details like that. He was a person. And those are the details that really, for me, brought Mike into three dimensions instead of that thing that he's always trying to be pigeonholed as.
Oh, that's so true, Mark. And, you know, I really latched onto those details. Every time I would have a little bit of a detail like that,
you
know, somewhere in my memory, I'd go back and kind of loop over it and say to myself, okay, what else can I remember? What was it like at that moment? What was, you know, who was Mike? And, you know, his voice in those letters is also incredibly powerful.
Oh, God. You know, those letters were really, both, as you mentioned before, they were both frightening and heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. And he becomes a person when you read those letters.
Oh, yeah.
You can hear his pain. You can hear
you also show his handwriting in one of the letters. And that was important, too. You know, it's like he's writing these out. He's feeling this. He's angry. He's hurt. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in his writing.
You know, you talked about how hard it is for us to really see people who have mental illness or, you know, the homeless people on the street that we don't want to deal with, to see them as people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like that really is the point of the book for me as a writer, is to see Mike. And I think that's where the hope comes. You know, my subtitle is A Story of Grief and Hope. And there's plenty of grief. And where's the hope? Well, I think the hope comes from being at the end of the story and being able to say, I've done my very best to see you, Mike. And I kind of think I do. You are a person. You are not just a diagnosis. You are my brother.
I think also the story of your mother and your father living through this comes out in different ways throughout this book. And your father, not Mike's father, but your father, both of them really tried to do their best to try to understand this. And they just didn't have the tools necessary in order to cope with this. I mean, your mother especially was just heartbroken.
So true. And it's so hard for us now to remember back to what things were like in the 50s when this began. You know, I've talked a lot with psychiatrists and psychologists who have helped me understand how much things have changed. You know, there really was no child psychology at all in the 50s. You know, parents had Dr. Spock to read about what it was, you know, what they needed to know to raise a kid. And that was about it. And so when Mike had this moment in his early teens when he began to disappear into anger and, you know, what may well have been psychosis, where were they going to turn? You know, there was no family therapy. There was no child psychologist on the corner. If they had been wealthy, perhaps like the Kennedys dealing with Rosemary, there would have been alternatives, but they weren't wealthy. And so they just did what the only thing they could do, try to get Mike out of the house because he was so threatening and so scary. And that meant the Colorado State Hospital. And so from that moment on, my mother, for the rest of her life, had to deal with the guilt.
Right, right,
and
right.
The pain of basically and
she needed some kind of therapy herself to help her go through it, and that just wasn't available. There wasn't a sense that the family members who are dealing with the problem also need help.
Yep.
And that's
we know that now.
Yeah, we know that now. There's a lot more to the story, but I want to sort of cut to the end because Mike's end was just horrific. Can you just briefly talk about that?
Yeah. So when Mike came back to Denver, he cut off contact with us in 1966. So I'm in high school. He's in his 20s. And our only contact for the next 9 years is to just exchange a card now and then. My mother would send him a birthday card and a check, and at least through high school, I remember sending him birthday presents and Christmas presents, carton of cigarettes, aftershave, you know, really generic stuff, and we would get brief notes back. But we didn't see him. He did not want to see us. And
You saw him out on the street, though.
No, he's not out on the street. He's living in halfway houses.
All right, but didn't you at one point see him out on the street and you just didn't go over and say hello?
That's right, yeah. In about 1970, I was back in Denver, home from college, driving through downtown Denver in our old sort of pinkish tan 1962 Dodge Dart, a car I was very fond of. You may remember how ugly
they
were.
Oh, yeah, they were bad.
And so I'm on Broadway in downtown Denver, the street that goes right between the state capitol and city hall. And I look off to my right. It's a winter day, khaki-colored grass, you know, black leafless trees, gray day. and there were a bunch of people all bundled up next to the vents coming, you know, with steam coming out of the curb, standing waiting for a bus. And there's Mike. Mike is standing right there on the curb. And I'm a couple of lanes over, and I can't get over immediately, but I'm not even sure that I want to. You know, it's, will he, what would I say? And I'm 20 years old. I'm still a kid. And I'm a little scared, but I'm riveted by Mike. And I look over there, and I just keep looking at him as I drive past. And I just let the traffic carry me away. And that was the last time I saw him. 6 years after that, I'm off in grad school in Arizona. And Mike is now 33 and living in one of those boarding houses. And my cousin in Denver comes to my parents' house in the Denver suburbs for dinner. As you know, my mother loved to cook for people. Cooking was an act of love for her. And my cousin was coming for dinner. She picked up the Denver Post as she walked into the house, you know, an afternoon newspaper, and opened it up and just glanced at it. And the headline on the front page was, "Death Knocked and Only Mike Was Listening."
We're going to have to end it there because we're out of time, and people are going to have to read the book. And we didn't do this intentionally, by the way, but to sell them. But I want to say one of the most powerful things is the very end of the book, where you write a long reimagining of the life Mike could have led, if society and individuals, if everything worked the way it should. And I found that just so sad because it was a blueprint for how he could have lived an okay life.
That really felt like the way I needed to end the book, to give us some hope and to let us know that it really could have been so different.
But it's also, it's a blueprint for how we should be dealing with these problems.
It's true. Yeah, I tried to use everything I had learned to create that blueprint. And it's a blueprint we've known for a long time. We could do it.
I know.
We just funded it.
It's like a lot of other things like this. We know what we need to do. We just don't do it.
So true. So true.
My guest tonight is writer and photographer Stephen Trimble. And we've been talking about his book. It's a powerful memoir, The Mike File, A Story of Grief and Hope. Stephen, it's been a pleasure.
My pleasure too, Mark. You know, it was just great to do this interview with you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.